You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
A great vampire squid wrapped around the face of humanity, relentlessly jamming its blood funnel into anything that smells like money. That's how Rolling Stone political reporter Matt Taibbi describes Goldman Sachs. In his article, The Great American Bubble Machine, Mr. Taibbi argues that the investment bank has been behind every major market manipulation since the Great Depression. Needless to say, the article has generated a fair amount of praise and its share of controversy, and I'm pleased that it brings Matt Taibbi back to the show today. Hello, Matt.
Hello. How's it going, Leonard?
I'm okay. You say that Goldman Sachs has manipulated whole economic sectors for years at a time, and then, in your words, moved the dice game just as the market collapsed. How is it possible that just one of the many investment banks could do something like that?
Well, it's obviously a little bit hyperbolic to solely blame Goldman Sachs for everything that went on. I mean, there was a little bit of hyperbole that went into the headline making there, but Goldman is definitely a unique phenomenon on Wall Street, over and above all the other investment banks, even more so than Morgan Stanley and J.P. Morgan and all Bank of America and all these other great commercial institutions. Goldman kind of occupies a sort of a gray area between public and private that no company, maybe even in American history, since Standard Oil really has. They have an enormous amount of influence with the government for a variety of reasons, but most importantly because they have so many of their former employees who've moved on from Goldman and assumed high-ranking positions in the government and especially in the financial regulatory arena, and they're able to get almost anything that they ask for as a result of that.
They maintain their loyalty even after they leave?
Well, it sure looks like that. I mean, it's hard to make a concrete case that, you know, say Lloyd Blankfein, the CEO of Goldman Sachs, called up the former head of Goldman Sachs, Hank Paulson, and said, hey, you know, we're in trouble. This would be last year. You know, AIG owes us $20 billion, and we're going to lose it if they go bankrupt. So can you get a taxpayer bailout of AIG, and can you give us a lot of that money? Well, we can't make that case. We do know that Lloyd Blankfein was in the room when the AIG bailout happened. And we do know that Goldman ended up getting at least $13 billion, straight through the AIG bailout. So, you know, we know that these things, all the appearances are that Goldman gets pretty much everything that it asked for.
They got the money. It didn't go to AIG. It came directly to Goldman. That the same sort of thing didn't happen with the bailout of Chrysler or General Motors. The creditors there didn't get very much money.
That's right. Yeah. Goldman got 100 cents in the dollar. On the money that AIG owed it, which, you know, was, if you remember, that during the Chrysler issue and the GM issue, everyone was howling about how, you know, the Obama administration gave such a sweetheart deal to the union workers when they were getting like 50 or 55 cents in the dollar for the money that they were owed. But Goldman got 100 cents in the dollar from the money that they were owed by AIG.
Just yesterday, a Senate panel issued subpoenas to Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan Chase seeking evidence of fraud tied to last year's mortgage crisis. It's already known that the company sold bundled mortgages and that it then bet against them. Do you think there's enough information already available to the public to make the case for fraud?
Absolutely. And I talked to a lot of people who said it's almost impossible to argue that there wasn't securities fraud there, because what Goldman was doing, and not just Goldman, obviously other investment banks were doing the same thing, but Goldman was kind of alone in the sense that they were betting against this stuff. They were taking these gigantic bundles of subprime mortgages, and these were terrible mortgages. They had in one deal that they did, the average equity to value ratio in the mortgage was 99.21%, which means there was almost no money in these houses. People were putting nothing down. One out of every six of the houses in that deal of the mortgages were defaulting within 18 months.
So they knew that these were bad.
These were terrible deals, and they were selling them as AAA rated instruments to, you know, mostly unsuspecting pension funds and institutional investors, and then turning around and basically betting against the same stuff. And that's sort of the essence of securities fraud. You know that this stuff is bad, and you're betting against it.
They were selling mortgage bundles, so there could have been good things mixed in. In 2006, a third of the $76.5 billion in mortgages Goldman underwrote were subprime.
Right, but it's actually that number is even worse because they did $76 billion in mortgages, but $59 billion of those were either subprime or Alt-A. And Alt-A is a category that's kind of between prime and subprime. But Alt-A, basically, in this boom year, it disintegrated basically into subprime. It was no documentation, no job. We didn't know most of the time who these people were who were taking these mortgages out.
And you said that many of those bundled mortgages were bought by city and state pension funds. Did Goldman specifically target sales to them?
Well, obviously, the people go after these institutional investors. These people, like CalPERS, the teachers, the fund that handles the teachers' retirement fund in California, which is the biggest one in America. These institutional investors, they have an enormous amount of money. They have a gigantic need for AAA rated securities, and they just don't always have the wherewithal to check everything that they're buying.
Wait, so those bundled mortgages were getting AAA ratings?
They were getting AAA ratings because...
Well, that's not Morgan. I mean, that's not Goldman's fault.
Indirectly, it sort of is, though, because they, as it happens, Moody's and Standard & Poor's and all the ratings agencies were almost wholly financially dependent upon banks like Goldman Sachs. And so they were giving them whatever ratings they wanted. It was manifestly obvious to everybody in the business as early as 2005 and 2006 that these mortgage-backed securities were not as safe as Treasury bonds. I mean, they should not have gotten AAA ratings, but they were.
Hasn't Goldman been sued over its role in the housing crisis?
It has, but every time it gets sued, it ends up with a minuscule fine. The classic example is Massachusetts sued it for its role in dealing in fraudulent and risky mortgages. It ended up paying a $50 million fine, which is like what its fixed income desk makes in half a day or something like that. And they didn't have to make it a formal admission of wrongdoing. There's a similar case here in New York. The New York State Comptroller's Office is suing Goldman Sachs for almost exactly the same thing. The likelihood is that it's going to come down and it's going to be a small fine.
My guest is Matt Taibbi, whose article called The Great American Bubble Machine is in Rolling Stone. He is a political correspondent for Rolling Stone. What was Goldman's relationship with AIG?
Well, during this whole period when everybody was investing in these crazy mortgage-backed securities, Goldman was buying credit default swaps with AIG. And
we're talking about two giants here. We're talking about an insurance giant and an investment bank giant.
Right, but AIG also had a small unit in its company called AIG FP, which is sort of like an investment bank itself. It was dealing in these crazy derivative instruments called credit default swaps. And basically what this was is they were selling protection to Goldman Sachs in the event that certain, of these mortgage-backed securities and other kinds of, securities would default. But AIG did not have the money to cover those bets. It ended up making about $450 billion worth of these bets with Goldman Sachs and other banks, and it didn't have the money to cover it, which was ultimately precipitated its demise.
And then, as you say, with a bailout of AIG, Goldman Sachs got its money back. Did it take any loss?
Not on that, no. In fact, it ended up getting money two ways through the AIG bailout. It got almost $5 billion through the securities lending program, that debts that AIG had to Goldman Sachs. And then it got another $13 billion through the credit default swap stuff from AIG FP. So it got at least about $18 billion total through the AIG bailout.
How does that compare to other companies that bought credit default swaps?
Well, I mean, throughout this entire, for instance, people who lost an enormous amount of money during the housing, during the crisis last year on credit default swaps, and most people didn't get, even a fraction of what, the actual value of these things. But the people who had dealings with AIG, specifically these big players like Goldman and Deutsche Bank, they got 100 cents in the dollar again on that stuff.
Didn't Goldman Sachs stock value continue to nosedive to all-time lows even after the AIG bailout?
It did, yeah. And there was a lot of reporting, including by New York Magazine this week, that Goldman was in serious trouble even after the AIG bailout. But the fact, what really rescued Goldman was the fact that they were allowed to convert to bank holding company status. Goldman was an investment bank up until last year. Then, sort of overnight, despite the fact that by law they had to wait 5 days, the Fed allowed them to convert overnight to become a commercial bank, and that made them eligible for a whole range of new programs where they could borrow money from the government basically for free, and give them access to this cheap money that they were then able to use to fund all their businesses that they've made so much money on the last year or so.
But it also put them under new regulations.
Not really. It didn't really work out that way. Goldman was able to maintain almost all of its old investment banking activities, even though. It is now technically a bank holding company. In fact, recently it's actually jacked up its risk ratios to levels that it hadn't seen even last year, which is not the kind of thing you typically see from a commercial bank.
Much has been made of the decision by former Goldman CEO and Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson to let Goldman Sachs' main competitor, Lehman Brothers, fail. Secretary Paulson said that he let it fail because Wall Street needed to understand moral hazard. Do you think that's what was really going on? Why didn't moral hazard apply to Goldman, Merrill Lynch, or AIG?
That's the question that everybody's asking. I mean, obviously there was a pecking order. They must have decided last year that, AIG needs to be bailed out, Goldman Sachs needs to be bailed out. Bear Stearns and J.P. Morgan need financial assistance. Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, they all needed government assistance. But somebody had to get left out, and that somebody turned out to be Lehman Brothers. And for a lot of people that I talk to, that decision that Paulson made that week, where he not only lets Lehman die, but he greenlights this massive taxpayer bailout of AIG, which rescues Goldman, for them that was like the last straw.
Well, the argument at the time was that the bailouts were necessary because these companies were too big to fail. Was Lehman not too big to fail?
Well, it turned out that Lehman might have been too big to fail. Clearly, what happened after
Lehman... It almost brought the whole thing down.
And there's significant evidence that there was sort of a split among the people who were, instituting the bailout, that there were two camps kind of around. One was around Paulson. One was around Tim Geithner, who was then at the New York Federal Reserve, that maybe Geithner wanted to rescue Lehman. Paulson was adamantly against it. But, we know what ultimately happened there.
Bailout recipients often called what they were getting investments. What do you think of that terminology?
Well, the argument that they're making is that, everybody's going to be making money off the fact that the government ended up injecting capital into these companies. But, the TARP and the warrants that the government bought in these companies, that is only a small slice of the government assistance that these companies got. The bigger part of the bailout was the access to almost unlimited cheap money that these banks got. And the public isn't going to see any return from that.
So we shouldn't be all that impressed that Goldman Sachs has paid back its $10 billion in TARP money. It claims that taxpayers earned an annualized 23% return on that investment.
The taxpayers are – that is a drop in the bucket compared to what all these companies got in the last year or so. I mean, just look at what happened to ordinary interest rates. Every American – that did the right thing and saved their money and kept their money in a savings account, they saw their savings rates slashed this year because there's so much cheap money in the market that the banks are getting their money basically for free. And so they don't have, they're making all that money on the spread, and the ordinary people who are keeping their money in their bank accounts are losing. So, there's that now.
Before we go to a break, I want to ask you a question that a listener left on a comment. Left on our show page. It's why do pension funds always seem to get into this kind of mess where they seem to invest in the wrong things? If they have so much to invest, some of that money should be going into doing proper research. I'm not excusing Goldman, but institutions like this have a history.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And, there's a lot of corruption that goes on with these pension funds. I mean, I talked to some guys who used to work for the big investment banks, and they would say, we'd call up these yokels who ran these state pension funds, and a lot of these guys are on state salaries, and we'd say, hey, guy, you want to go to the Super Bowl this year, or do you want to eat at Spago's three times a week, or something like that. And these guys, they fall into the life. There's all kinds of inducements that they use to get these pension funds sort of on the hook. And they, ultimately they end up being roped into the game, and everybody else is the loser.
My guest is Matt Taibbi, political correspondent for Rolling Stone. We're talking about some of the things he's written about in an article called The Great American Bubble Machine about Goldman Sachs. Stay with us for more. We're back with Matt Taibbi, political correspondent for Rolling Stone. His article, The Great American Bubble Machine, the article we're talking about, is linked on our show page at WNYC.org, in case you want to read the complete thing. Another colorful description you've come up with, Matt, for Goldman Sachs, is that it's a planet-eating Death Star of political influence. Must be fun writing those things. Can you give us a quick rundown of the most prominent, powerful people who used to work for Goldman Sachs? You've mentioned a few, but
sure,
it's a long list, isn't it?
It's an incredibly long list. You know, obviously the key figures are Bill Clinton's former Treasury Secretary Bob Rubin, who was the head of Goldman Sachs back in the early 90s. then Hank Paulson, obviously, Bush's Treasury Secretary. Neel Kashkari, who was the minister of the TARP program. He was also, a Goldman guy. Josh Bolton, who was Bush's White House chief of staff, was Goldman. The current number two guy in the Treasury, Mark Patterson, was a former Goldman lobbyist, which is interesting because Barack Obama promised there would be no registered lobbyists in his White House. The head of the CFTC, which regulates the commodities markets, Gary Gensler, is a Goldman Sachs banker. The head of the New York Stock Exchange, the World Bank, the Bank of Canada, the Bank of Italy, the New York Federal Reserve, is now run by a former Goldman guy, William Dudley. So the list is just incredibly long.
Of course, there's another side to that. Goldman has a great reputation on Wall Street, and we would assume that people who come out of it really know what they're doing. I'd like to play a clip from an interview I conducted in October of last year with Charles Ellis, a former advisor to Goldman and other investment houses. Here's how he described the company.
My own very strong view, as I've known these guys over years and years and years, is that they are the best bag of really straight-ahead, trustworthy, honest, unbelievable, not Boy Scouts in the sense of being prissy, but they play by the rules. Play hardball, but they play by the rules.
So, Matt, you're saying they don't play by the rules.
I mean, how many
times—
Or
that they create the rules.
They create the rules, but, I mean, even the rule, going by the rules they help create, Goldman has been sued and fined, more times than I can conceivably count for violations going back to the internet boom years. Again, the housing business, they've paid numerous fines. And, these guys, I don't think they have really that reputation anymore. I think it's beginning to change a little bit on Wall Street. They're perceived now as people who use government influence to make money to the detriment of the other houses on Wall Street. And that's why they get these derisive nicknames on Wall Street, like Government Sachs. They're also called the government's girlfriend on Wall Street. I think people have a different image of them now.
Ellis also told me that the company hires in the top 5% from top schools and that its employees are just smarter than the people who work at the other investment houses.
Well, yeah, that's their excuse. They also say that they have a strong attaboy culture. The people who mentor the juniors in that company leave voicemail messages congratulating them for great deals, and that there's a strong internal culture. But the reality is, the reason they made a $3.4 billion profit this year is because they got $19 billion from the government, and they were allowed to issue $28 billion in FDIC backed debt. That's how they make their money. They're not smarter than other people.
My staff keeps on adding people to the list of former Goldman employees. John Corzine.
Right.
Jim Cramer of CNBC.
Aaron Burnett, too, also at CNBC.
You also claim that Goldman Sachs was responsible for the tech bubble in the late 1990s. Really?
Well, Goldman Sachs was the leading underwriter of internet companies. One out of every five, at the height of the boom, one out of every five internet companies that was taken public by Goldman Sachs.
Yahoo! Which is now kind of disappearing,
right,
as it's being merged into Microsoft.
Right, although that's, ironically enough, one of the success stories compared to a lot of the other companies that were taken public. The thing that's important to remember about the internet years is that, for time immemorial, no investment bank would take a company public unless it had existed for 5 years, unless it had been profitable for 3 years, unless it was profitable at the time of the IPO, and unless it was projected to make money in the next 2 years. Goldman threw all those all those standards out the window, and this collapse of underwriting standards that was across the industry, not just Goldman, was what led basically to the tech problems, because all these companies were taken public. People invested tons of money in them, but they had no history, they had no future, and no earnings, no real earnings, and that's why it blew up on everybody.
But Goldman was making money from those internet IPOs.
Absolutely, Goldman was making money, and also the executives of the companies that were being taken public were making money, you know, through a variety of techniques, including things called laddering and spinning.
And what is laddering?
Laddering is a situation where a bank like Goldman will go to a prize client and say, hey, you know, we're going to give you, you know, 1 million shares of this new company at a price of 16, a low price, but you have to agree to come back in at 24 and buy more shares. And if they do that, that way Goldman and this client both know that it's going to achieve a bump early on in the process.
Well, isn't that a form of insider trading?
It is a form of insider trading, and they were fined for those violations in the agreement that the settlement that Goldman and other banks had to come to with Elliott Spitzer. But again, it was a minuscule fine. I think they only paid something like $10 million for that, which is like what they made in like 10 minutes during that period.
And spinning?
Spinning is another thing where they go to the executives, for instance, of a company that's being taken public. And they agree to give them shares, these guys personally shares in the IPO at a low price in exchange for promises that they will bring their future underwriting business to the bank. So again, this is a situation where, you know, a couple of insiders know something that everybody in the outside doesn't know, and it's also a form of stock manipulation.
And have they been fined for that?
They were fined as per the same agreement with Spitzer. They were fined, and I think the same fine actually, you know, pertained to the same violation. So again, it was like almost a minuscule fine wasn't really commensurate.
I want to get back to the whole business of they're selling these IPOs for untested companies. Whenever I talk about those things, just as when I talked about the Bernard Madoff Ponzi scheme, there are a number of listeners who I think quite reasonably ask, well, who should we really be blaming for this? And we got that question earlier, why are all of these pension funds buying into such bad things? Is this really a matter of buyer beware, and why aren't the buyers a little more aware?
Well, okay. Certainly, it's the fault of the people who are buying this stuff. But the fact is that Wall Street was better off when there were these standards. You know, in the case of the internet boom, clearly the people who were buying these companies, they had to know that these, you know, fly-by-night internet companies were a bigger risk than, say, you know, the IPOs that were taken public 30 years ago. But in the case of the housing industry, where there was a similar collapse in underwriting standards, where, for instance, you know, it used to be that you couldn't buy a house unless you put 20% down. You had to have a fixed job. You had to have a fixed address and identification and all that stuff. There was even more at work, because without the securitization process that banks like Goldman Sachs perfected, there would not have been a market for those fraudulent mortgages that were lent out. So the banks actually played a bigger role in the decline of underwriting standards in the housing thing than they did in the internet years. And I think that they were more guilty then than they were in the internet boom.
My guest is Matt Taibbi, political correspondent for Rolling Stone. We're talking about the Great American Bubble Machine, an article he has in the current issue?
No, it was actually like a month ago now, but it's still being...
This is old news.
That's right.
Goldman Sachs has made
but
billions
since then. But
they're
still talking about it, right? Yeah, exactly.
There is a link to it on our show page at WNYC.org. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You mentioned Robert Rubin, the Goldman alum who was Treasury Secretary and now is back in the White House. What did he do to help Goldman?
Well, he did two things that were extremely important, not directly related to Goldman Sachs, but that contributed enormously to the financial crisis. And as Treasury Secretary, he pushed for two major deregulatory initiatives. One was the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act in 1998, which effectively repealed the Glass-Steagall Act, which was something that had been passed after the Depression, which prevented commercial banks, investment banks, and insurance companies from merging.
And now everyone is saying this was a bad idea.
It's a terrible idea, because without that law, without repealing that law, you could not have had these companies that were so-called too big to fail companies. Well, maybe you could have, but it wouldn't have been so easy. That concentration of capital power greatly increased the possibility for shenanigans and manipulation, and that's exactly what happened. So there was that, then there was also...
So what do you think he's saying now to Barack Obama? We'll come back to some of the other things.
We'll come back to that. The fact that Obama chose him to lead his economic transition team was pretty amazing in light of what happened. But there was that law. Then there was the Commodity Futures Modernization Act of 2000, which was something that he pushed heavily for, and was passed ultimately after he left the White House. But he this affirmatively deregulated derivatives. Like credit default swaps, collateralized debt obligations. And the fact that there was no real regulation of that stuff was what allowed specifically, like, the AIG disaster could not have happened if there had been any real regulation of that stuff. And that is pointed to now as one of the key moments in this whole business.
A number of suspicious listeners have called in wondering if you see a connection between the fall of Elliott Spitzer and the problems on Wall Street.
Well,
I mean, he did go to that call girl, but
right.
But it looked like they suddenly, like, everybody
went jumped after him. On him. Yeah, I do know that a lot of people thought, you know, who I talked to, who were sources of mine for the stories that I worked on, you know, kind of thought that after Spitzer left the scene, that a lot of people thought the dogs had been called off for good, you know, and that now and that there was never going to be any hope of any real reform as long he was probably the best chance for anything to be done. I think there are some people now who are, you know, Cuomo is talking about doing some things, and he's going after the bonuses that the TARP recipients have paid out this year. So maybe we might see a revival of some of that stuff in the future.
The New York Times reported on Tuesday that the country's top regulator of commodity markets said the government should seriously consider strict limits on the trades of purely financial investors in the futures market for oil, natural gas, and other energy products.
Yeah.
So are we seeing a shift in tone from Washington?
Well, yeah, but that's sort of reluctantly. That Gary Gensler, who is the head of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, he's a former Goldman Sachs banker. He was Rubin's number two in the White House and was very instrumental in deregulating the commodities markets through that 2000 law. When he was nominated by Obama, Bernie Sanders, a senator from Vermont, placed a hold on his nomination and said, I'm not going to allow this to go through unless he agrees to pass reforms to prevent the kind of speculation in the commodities markets that went on last year. And after a lot of horse trading, he did agree to do that. So what we're seeing now are kind of the fruits of those negotiations. And, you know, there will be some reform of the commodities market. What's important to note about that is that this is the government conceding that what happened last year was a result of speculation.
Another area that people are concerned about is fast trading.
Fast trading?
Yeah. Isn't that something that Goldman Sachs also got involved with?
I don't know.
Oh. Andrew Cuomo released a report yesterday on compensation at major banks. It said that banks did well, their employees were paid well. When banks do poorly, their employees were still paid well, and when the banks did very poorly, they were bailed out by taxpayers, and their employees were still paid well.
Right, that's sort of the heads I win, tails you lose kind of a method of compensation that everybody's complaining about, and I think a lot of people would point to kind of the changes in the way that people were compensated in Wall Street as being responsible for a lot of the things that went on, like especially after Salomon Brothers went public. Now the investment banks are playing with other people's money and not their own partners' money. And so the game became not about how do we build businesses for the long term so we all make money in the long term, but how do I make the biggest bonus for myself this year? And all that short-term thinking bled into all these different arenas.
Well, we are hearing that the Obama administration will be releasing new financial regulations soon. So there has been some adjustment made.
Right.
Are you concerned that they won't have as much bite as you would like?
Well, I think if you just look at the people who Obama appointed to run his financial policies, it doesn't inspire a whole lot of confidence that these are the people who are going to make enormous changes. I mean, Timothy Geithner is viewed on Wall Street as being a creature of these big investment banks. He was a protege of a number of different Goldman Sachs people. He worked under Stephen Friedman, who was a former Goldman banker at New York Fed. He worked under Bob Rubin. He's seen as being on that part and on that team. And then you have Patterson, you have Gensler, you have Rubin, you have Summers. All these guys are the same old people who have been there for years. So why would it change now?
And Goldman Sachs was one of the top donors to Barack Obama's presidential campaign.
It was the top private contributor to Obama's presidential
campaign. So how much did Goldman Sachs pay in taxes in 2008?
They paid $14 million in taxes last year.
That compare?
Well, it was effectively a 1% tax rate. They made a profit of $2.2 billion last year. So, you can do the math. They paid in taxes about a third of what the CEO, Lloyd Blankfein, actually made in compensation last year.
And at this time of great financial crisis, it announced large profits in both the first and second quarters of this year.
Right. They just announced a record profit of $3.44 billion for the second quarter. And it's almost pure government subsidy when you look at it. They made an enormous amount of money. One of the ways they made money is they were underwriting the stock issue for companies that needed to issue stock as per government instructions in order to repay their TARP commitments. So basically, the government dictated that the other banks had to issue stock according to certain regulations, and Goldman Sachs is one of the few players that was doing that kind of work. So they got they underwrote something like $750 million in securities this year.
Yep, painting a pretty depressing picture here. Is Goldman Sachs invincible?
Well, one of the problems is that they're a major contributor to both parties. They obviously have an in with both parties.
Hasn't a lot of the money shifted to the Democrats? Is that simply because the Democrats are now in power?
Well, yeah. What do these guys do for a living? They pick winners, right? I mean, last year they gave $4 to Democratic congressional candidates for every one to Republican candidates, but they just saw the writing on the wall. Clearly in the last two decades they've had key people put in high places throughout the regulatory structures of both the Democratic and the Republican administrations. And, when I talk to interview people in Congress, there's a widespread fear even among, sitting congressmen to say anything publicly about Goldman Sachs. I mean, you have a few scattered critics, but they're mostly people on the outside like Kucinich, Sanders, Ron Paul, people like that. The mainstream guys aren't going to take them on.
And you said you spoke to a congressman who was intimidated by Goldman lobbyists.
Yeah, in fact, I talked to one congressman who circulated something called a Dear Colleagues letter about Goldman Sachs, where he was complaining about something involving the AIG bailout. And within a day, he had Richard Gephardt, the former Democratic presidential candidate who's now a Goldman lobbyist, in his office complaining about it. He got calls from other Democratic congressmen saying, "I can't sign this letter if Goldman Sachs' name is on this letter." And then he told me that I couldn't use his name when I told this story because he's too afraid of the retribution that he might get from this investment bank. So, it just speaks to the influence that this bank has even in Congress.
That's kind of scary.
It is. It's very scary. And, I think it's an enormous cause of concern. It's something that increasingly comes up when you talk to staffers and people in Congress. They talk about the influence that these financial companies have, and they worry a lot about it.
You can read Matt Taibbi's article, The Great American Bubble Machine, by going to our show page at WNYC.org. Matt Taibbi is a political correspondent for Rolling Stone. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.